France's government has collapsed, South Korea's president attempted a coup, Russia and China are attacking the West in some unorthodox ways, and Joe Biden has pardoned his son Hunter. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. France's government collapsed on Wednesday as the French far-right leader, or fringe-right leader, Marine Le Pen, followed through on her threat with joining with the far-left and having both of them back a vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister, Michel Barnier. Mr. Barnier, he is now, or Monsieur Barnier, I should say, he's now the shortest-lived Prime Minister in modern French history. He's the first to be pushed out of office by Parliament since 1962. Calls are growing now for Emmanuel Macron himself to resign. Just about everything is on the table. There's talk of even a new constitution and the end of the Fifth Republic. Now, there isn't a clear mechanism to push Mr. Macron out, and he doesn't seem like the type of person who would quit voluntarily, particularly when it could lead to the end of the Fifth Republic. So it's quite hard to see where France goes from here. Parliament is split. There's a far left, there's a center, and there's a fringe right, basically, and it's about a third each. So no one can have a majority. There is no one leader that Emmanuel Macron can appoint as prime minister who will have an easy majority there. That's not simple to fix. France had an election last summer and then not allowed to hold another parliamentary election for another 12 months. So they've got to find a way to get by until next summer. Now, I think if Macron himself quits, there is a mechanism there to hold fresh elections. So there's the potential for France's National Assembly just to be so obstructionist that they try and leave Mr. Macron with no other option but quitting. But if they do that, I doubt we'll see that happen right away. I think Mr. Macron will stick to it a little bit longer. But he's also going to have a hard time even appointing a prime minister. There's names being tossed around. Nobody seems like they even want the job. Politico noted the political upheaval could hardly come at a worse time for Europe, which is in dire need of leadership to confront challenges ranging from the return of Donald Trump to the conflict in Ukraine and a potential trade war with China. Germany, the other half of the engine that powers the continent, is ill-equipped to take the reins while struggling with its own political mess and sputtering economy. This is indeed terrible timing for Europe. Germany, its coalition has collapsed. They're on the road to an election. They're on a kind of a slow road to an election. France's government has collapsed. They can't hold elections. And they're struggling to have any clear road to real power. Now, I should point out that the government fell apart over disagreements on the French budget. France's debt is 112% of the size of its economy. So the entire economic output of France was dedicated to paying off that debt. It would take France a bit over a year to pay that off. That's a little less than America's debt. That's 120% of the size of its economy. But the US has the world's reserve currency. People still very much want dollars. France lacks that advantage. It is in a dangerous position with its debt. I mean, America is in a dangerous position with its debt too. But I think they can perhaps eke things out a little longer before everything comes crashing down around them. Dollar being the reserve currency gives more of an illusion of stability, I think, or means that they can keep borrowing cheaply before everything falls apart. France is borrowing about 6% of the size of its economy every year. The European, in theory, legal mandatory target is 3%. So not only is the debt high, but it is going up at a very rapid rate. So it's completely unsustainable. And Michel Barnier had a very dramatic plan to try and deal with this debt and get that under control. Now he's out, and what the French President Emmanuel Macron said last night, and the other parties have gotten behind this, is they're just going to roll the 2024 budget over to 2025. So that's an easy way to prevent this immediate crisis where there was the possibility of France not being able to pay the bills or collect taxes because no budget had been signed. But it means that debt is just going to keep accelerating now. They're now expected to borrow the equivalent of 7% of the size of their economy in 2025. Nothing is going to be done, nothing whatsoever, for this next year to try and get this debt under control. And that's another year of not dealing with this problem while it gets worse. And France is too big to bail out. This moves all Europe towards economic crisis. I think right now nobody is massively concerned that France won't be able to pay the bills. But as we've seen in Greece, when something goes wrong, people start to get concerned very, very quickly. So this is creating a very hard problem for Europe to solve in the long run. And the echoes of the run-up to the French Revolution are very loud and clear, where you had prime minister after prime minister or finance minister or whatever getting fired as they tried to deal with the ballooning debt, and it was tremendously unpopular, and there was massive pushback against it, and this problem never got solved until it exploded. So this growing debt is another problem, another potential crisis in this perfect storm that Europe has to worry about. And I think another part of this that is important to keep in mind is that Germany's debt is about 63% of the size of its economy. If Germany dedicated its entire economic output to paying off its debt, it would do it in 7-8 months, much quicker than France or the United States. This is a key part of the reason why Germany dominates the European Union. Emmanuel Macron would love to dominate the European Union. He's a bit of a strongman personality, but he's got too much division at home. And then also, whenever anything goes wrong, whenever there's a bailout needed, or even when there's other troops that need to be committed somewhere, France doesn't have the money for a big spending project. But Germany, because they have kept their debt under control, is in a much better position there. And so this means that it's to Germany that the whole of the EU turns, cap in hand, not to France, because they know that France can't help them. And France, in fact, has to kind of turn around and turn to Germany. So that economic, it cements the continued dependence of France and the whole of the EU on Germany as we see France's economic spiral out of control. And we'll start opening the show with this because it is, you know, it's big news in its own right to have France going through this kind of political crisis. But Europe's leadership crisis is one of the most important prophetic trends to be watching right now. Herbert W. Armstrong forecast for years the rise of a strong leader in Europe. And it looks like we're right on the brink of seeing that man come in with all of these different leadership crises going on in different countries. Here's what Mr. Armstrong wrote. He said, "Germany inevitably will emerge as the leader of a united Europe. It will require some spiritual binding force to inspire this confidence, to remove these fears. And that spiritual binding force must arise from inside Europe." And I think that is something critical to watch for at the moment. But Mr. Armstrong continued, "All Europe is actually ready, just waiting for the confidence-inspiring leader. That man is there somewhere." I mean, Mr. Armstrong didn't know exactly when he would appear, but we can certainly say that today. That man is there somewhere, and all Europe needs some kind of confidence-inspiring leader. These are the biggest challenges Europe has faced in a generation. Syria is falling apart. Russia is taking Ukraine. German helicopters are being shot at by Russia. They need a strongman. They need somebody. Well, they need government of some kind. And yet, German politics is chaos, French politics is chaos, and you look at the polls, even countries that can have elections sooner than France, there's no clear way out of all of this. So watch for Europe to settle on a strongman, for him to come into power by some unorthodox route. The Bible tells us that you're going to have this kind of strongman. That's why Mr. Armstrong made this forecast all of these years ago. There are many scriptures throughout the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, these two primary books of Bible prophecy, that talk about there being a strong man rising onto the scene, leading an empire of many different nations, 10 different nations, all uniting under one strong man. And the book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 8, if you look in the original Hebrew, talks about this strong man coming into power by unorthodox means. And when you see democracy deadlocked the way that it is, well, that really opens the gates for someone to come into power by unorthodox means. Europe needs leadership. Democracy can't provide it right now, so they'll look for something else. This is one of the key subjects in our latest Trumpet print edition. Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has an article there. After Trump's victory, watch Germany, where he goes through these prophecies and shows exactly why we're watching for this strongman to rise in Europe. I think when you see France now falling apart as well as Germany, that just makes that article all the more critical. In there, he points to Kamala Harris as the kind of way that the strongman could come into power, where there's a decision of, okay, we need a new Democratic candidate. We do not have time for the normal voting systems, they decided. We do not have time to do this the way we would typically. So we'll just parachute someone in at the top and try and make that work. That's the kind of thing that European leaders will do. And that's how this strongman will come to power. So that article, after Trump's victory, watch Germany, is a critical one to understand world news right now. And you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can just look for that Trump, our latest Trumpet magazine down the right-hand side. It's got Miracle Victory and a picture of Donald Trump on the cover. If you click that, you can get all of the articles. You can also get your own free subscription to this magazine as well. And we're very happy to send this to you. You get all of our most important articles in a way that you can easily study and digest. That comes out 10 times a year. There's no follow-up. We're not going to request donations. We're not going to be badgering you to come to services with us or anything like that. You just get the magazine, and once a year we ask you if you want to keep getting it. And apart from that, you won't hear anything else from us. So we'd be very happy to send you that, and you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. I also wanted to talk about a couple of stories from here in the UK. So Mohammed is the most popular name for newborn baby boys in England and Wales, according to statistics released by the Office of National Statistics on Thursday. Mohammed is also the 28th most popular baby name, and Mohammed is the 68th most popular boys' baby name. So it's filling all of these slots. In previous years, if you combined all the different spellings of Muhammad into one, it would be in the number one slot. This year, though, if you just leave the different spellings where they are, those are three different varieties of spelling Muhammad, in case that wasn't clear, you can leave those where they are, and the one spelling itself, Muhammad, is enough to take the number one spot. It's a powerful sign of just how much migration has changed the face of British society. And then last Friday, Britain's parliament voted to legalize suicide, legalize euthanasia, to have the National Health Service help people kill themselves. It was a vote 330 to 275. And I think, you know, I try to understand things from other people's point of view. I think we all do. And yeah, I can see how somebody would support euthanasia, how they could say, well, rather than allowing somebody to continue to suffer, the compassionate thing to do is to help them kill themselves or let them to, like, I don't agree with that. I can understand how someone would. And we've seen this play out, though, in Canada. And the Canadian experience has been absolutely horrific. And what was kind of marketed as this mercy killing for the terminal ill has led to people being executed for hearing loss. It's led to thousands being killed by the state to avoid the cost of staying alive. It's about a third of people that killed themselves in Canada under their medical assistance and dying program cite cost of living or new cost as a core reason of why they're doing it. In just a couple of years, those only suffering from mental illness, so with no physical issues, they'll be able to, the Canadian government will help kill them. So somebody could call up the doctor and say, hey doc, I'm feeling depressed. And the doctor might say, oh, well, have you considered suicide? The director of the Canadian Institute for Inclusion and Citizenship, Tim Stanton, he called Canada's euthanasia law probably the biggest existential threat to disabled people since the Nazis' program in Germany in the 1930s. I mean, one man talked about how the hospital ethicist came and tried to pressure him into killing himself, or really pressure him into having the state kill him. You know, saying, well, you're costing all of these resources, all of these taxpayers' money. We're having to spend so much money. We'd be able to help so many more people with that money if you would only kill yourself. Trust me, I'm an ethicist. You need to die. That is the right thing to do. So for Canada to legalize this and end up in this absolutely horrific place that is getting worse and worse to the point that now the state killing you is becoming a leading cause of death for young people in Canada. Like, that is horrific. And to me, Canada is this perfect example of, okay, we can lean to our own understanding and we could decide, yeah, well, actually, I think it is compassionate to allow terminally ill people that are suffering to kill themselves. But if what we're doing and what we're reasoning is not based on God's law and we're doing it differently to what the Bible says, it's going to end in disaster. And Canada vividly shows that. And then I just can't believe that Britain sees Canada and says, yes, we're going to do the same thing. Like, eyes wide open. They have watched Canada toboggan down that slippery slope so fast. And now we're getting our toboggan out as well. Now, it's not the end of the road in Britain. It was, I think, the second reading of the law. People did promise, well, we're going to scrutinize this and we'll have a third. And I think the person that proposed it even misled Parliament by saying that other countries hadn't had a slippery slope here. There is a chance for a turnaround. I find that unlikely. I think it was probably more of a cop-out on behalf of the people that were saying that. But it's a terrible, terrible story there. It's a story in Canada that I wrote more on last year in a Trumpet Print article called Medical Murder. We could put a link in the show notes if you want to see more evidence of some of those statistics that I just cited there. But I think a shocking, shocking story out of the UK. And then a final one from Europe, where a Russian warship fired at a German helicopter. Now, it was signal ammunition, so warning shots rather than live fire. But you know, this is more acts from Russia that are really going to sow fear in Europe. And this, after Russia invaded Crimea in 2014, Mr. Flory wrote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire." Now, that fear of Russia is going to transform Europe. And that's something to keep in mind, I think, as we turn to Jeremiah and talk to him about some of his stories this week. But before we get into some of what Russia is doing, one of the big questions I think that is on everybody's mind is, what on earth is going on with South Korea?
Yes, it was a truly dramatic week for South Korea. On Tuesday night, the president suddenly declared martial law. And this was the first time in almost 50 years that martial law has been declared in South Korea. And they actually have two different types of martial law in the country. They've got precautionary and extraordinary. And the precautionary martial law is more of a preventative measure, and it doesn't give the president very much extra authority. And so that was, of course, not the one that President Yoon implemented. He implemented extraordinary martial law, and that gave him extraordinary power, allowing him to really control many aspects of the government and the public during a state of crisis of this time. All political activity is banned and media is restricted. Arrests are also allowed even without warrants. Basically, the military has full authority with the president up at the head of the military. So it's quite a drastic emergency declaration that President Yoon made here. Now, he said that this was aimed at thwarting what he called anti-state forces in the South Korean government. He was basically accusing some of his opposition of being aligned with communist North Korea. And so that was what he said was the rationale behind this crisis declaration. But it actually seems to have been just a political ploy designed to keep President Yoon from being impeached. Several motions have been filed against him and his wife for things like investment fraud. And the people and the legislators of South Korea, they knew this very well. So they protested immediately against Yoon's martial law declaration. Members of South Korea's parliament raced to the National Assembly building, even though this was all in the middle of the night. They raced over there, and it was very dramatic to see them trying to get inside the building to vote while soldiers were blocking the way. Just wild to see footage of Korean MPs climbing over a big fence to get inside of the parliament. But many of them did get inside, and the Korean special forces actually tried to storm parliament at that point to try to stop the voting from happening, since political activity is supposed to be banned during a state of martial law. But the legislators were able to finally vote, and they voted unanimously, 190-0, to end President Yoon's state of martial law. At that point, the soldiers didn't really know what to do, but eventually they decided to abide by the parliament's vote. And then Yoon was forced to accept this vote. You know, once you lose the military, you don't really have much. So it didn't last long. And now President Yoon is expected to be impeached very soon. This martial law stunt seems to have been just a real Hail Mary for him, and it didn't land. And so his days as head of the nation now are very much numbered.
It's a very sobering story. I think, I don't know necessarily what it's like with the United States, but South Korea is not a massive tourist destination for people from Europe. It's a long way away. But they're very much looked upon as one of us, you know, one of the West, that they're a wealthy, developed nation with a mature, established part. Like, it's one thing if you have a coup in Fiji or Mali or one of these countries that rightly or wrongly we look at as quite different from the West, and we're not generally surprised to see that there. But to have that happen in South Korea, that's, I think it shocked a lot of people for good reason. And it is really sobering to see a mature democracy, to see something that, at least according to, you know, one worldview, has reached kind of the end point of political development, of becoming a capitalistic, democratic society, and then to have all of that just so quickly be under threat.
I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because like you said, South Korea is not some irrelevant backwater nation. You know, this South Korea actually has the world's fifth most powerful military, according to most rankings that I've seen, and the world's 12th most powerful economy. So this is a major nation. And of course, it's often upheld as just a paragon of democracy. People contrast it with North Korea and say, look at this success story. Look at, you know, this beacon of prosperity and innovation. And South Korea does have many admirable virtues, but this declaration of martial law and all the political intrigue that surrounds this, it does show that even a staunch democracy, even what we would call a success story, it's all quite fragile. And democracy does have, you know, of course, many, many very serious pitfalls. I'm often reminded of Winston Churchill's assessment of it when he said, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the other ones that mankind has tried.
And it reminded me of the February 2020 Trumpet Print Edition that was this kind of special issue all about government and different types of government. And I think it says the age of protest on the front cover. And we talked about this idea that is democracy inevitable and a success in there. And yeah, I think it did really point to some of those broader lessons. But and you've also got maybe some less dramatic, less eye-catching, but very much important stories to talk about this week for your main story.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the big one that I wanted to talk about is that TikTok admitted this week, they begrudgingly admitted that tens of thousands of their most outspoken users in Romania were largely Russians who were influencing the presidential election there in illegal ways. So over the last several weeks, these extremely active TikTok accounts were aggressively targeting and retargeting and retargeting Romanian voters ahead of Romania's presidential election. These accounts were often posing as Romanians, patriotic Romanians, and just filling the heads of the real Romanians with all kinds of pro-Russia falsehoods, all the Kremlin's smoke and mirrors. So the Russians were just bombarding these voters for weeks. And they also conducted apparently a very sophisticated cyber attack that allowed them to avoid being labeled on TikTok as a political ad, even though that's exactly what their posts really were. And it worked. It played a significant role in Romania's presidential election. It was enough to help the pro-Russian fringe candidate to win the first round of voting. That is Calin Georgescu. So TikTok has now taken down many of these pro-Russian fake accounts. It took down 66,000 of these accounts, as well as about 10 million fake followers. And those might sound like pretty big numbers, you know, 66,000 fake accounts, 10 million fake followers. But we should keep in mind that those are only the ones that Russia used for Romania's election. And that's only the accounts on TikTok. So if you multiply those kinds of numbers out across all of the countries that Russia is trying to influence and multiply it across all the different platforms, then you start to get a feel for just how much power Russia has bought itself on social media. So when you log into X or YouTube or Instagram or TikTok and you see hundreds of thousands of accounts praising Russia, defending Russia, acting as apologists for Russia and Putin, and at the same time you see them victim blaming all of Russia's various victims, you know, coming up with hundreds of reasons why Georgia or Moldova or Ukraine should not be helped. You should know that in many cases, this is not really your fellow American or your fellow Briton or your fellow Romanian siding with Russia. You know, when you see Dallas Patriot 543 making these kinds of statements, and you see Florida Girl for Trump making these kinds of statements about how upright Russia is and how corrupt the Republic of Georgia is, that's not really a Dallas Patriot or a girl from Florida in a lot of cases. In many cases, that's Boris in Moscow. And he's on Putin's payroll, posing as something that he's not. And he's posting pro-Russian propaganda 10 or 12 or 16 hours a day. And of course, a lot of it is also automated. It's a well-established fact that Putin uses armies of bots to amplify the voices of his real human trolls. And the Russians also run actual news sites as well, like South Front, sites that look like US kind of alt-right sites. So it's not just social media, but it's actual publications. And then the Russian trolls also spend a lot of time amplifying pro-Russian content from Zero Hedge and InfoWars and in certain Tucker Carlson reports and other pro-Russia Western messages.
Well, it's a bit of like the Zero Hedge, it's a bit of a circular thing, because then Zero Hedge take material written by people in the Kremlin employ. You know, there are various different, like, it's all kind of laundered. I think there's something called like the Center for Strategic Studies. I can't remember what it is. It's got some kind of acronym like that. But you look at it and it's basically Russian government funded. And then that'll be on Zero Hedge. I mean, I think they're a useful news source. I read them quite regularly. I think this is what makes this subject so tricky, because in a lot of ways, Zero Hedge will help you find very useful sources that don't get reported by CNN and many of these others. So we need alternative media outlets. But then Russia is able to really take advantage of that need and push some of these other things.
Yes, yes, I fully agree. It's quite a complex situation, but this is a major story, and I think an underreported story, because what it means is that real people, whether they're in Romania or the UK or France or Germany or America, they see these pro-Russian accounts and posts, and they see what appears to be overwhelming support for Russia and overwhelming condemnation of Russia's victims like Georgia or Ukraine or democracy in Romania. And with enough real people seeing that and reading it, many of them are persuaded, especially, as you said, in this age when more and more people are rejecting mainstream media for what are very often very valid reasons. But this development is important because real people end up being won over to a lot of Russian talking points, or at the very least, they get very confused, too confused to be able to recognize aggression. And they start to think that it's all complicated. It's not black and white. It's all shades of gray. There's fault on every side. Some of them just throw up their hands and say, who knows? It's a crazy world. And that also plays into Putin's strategy. And this is exactly why Vladimir Putin spends billions of rubles annually to wage this multifaceted information war against Western nations. He is poisoning the wells of discourse. And it means that many real people are influenced by Russia's propaganda and end up parroting a lot of those same, you know, Kremlin talking points.
This story kind of caught my attention because I was watching the Romanian election. This is big for Europe. And, you know, you mentioned, was it Kellen Georgescu, who I probably butchered that. But anyway, he was the surprise kind of going through to the next round of the presidential elections. And we'll still see how he does that. But he didn't campaign at all on mainstream media. Like, his campaign was very much largely on TikTok. So when you've got a whole bunch of Russian bots basically on TikTok, like, that won him the election, or at least won him what was a shocking victory. Again, we don't know if he's going to win overall, but he did incredibly well, and he wasn't really in any mainstream media. I mean, we saw, going back to Romania this week, The far right party has doubled their vote, I think from 9% to 18%. And this is a party that has, I mean, it goes all the way. They've had support for what was basically Romania's version with the Nazis. I think it was the Iron Guard back in the 1930s, the 1940s. And because they're doing so well, Russia's mainstream coalition that they are, Romania's mainstream coalition of left and right, they don't have enough support. Like, you're getting to the point where people are very worried that this NATO member, EU member, that's crucial for the eastern flank of NATO and the EU, could drop out of the Western alliance and could become this pro-Putin nation. That is, and then a lot of, you know, he can win a massive victory this way with influencing that election. Now, well, two things. I think one, it's deeply ironic, given that Russia has said we're going into Ukraine to fight Nazis, to find them backing neo-Nazis, literal neo-Nazis in Romania. I tend to be a little bit skeptical that social media really does influence people that much. There is always a part of me that asks, are people that dumb? Like, or don't we just tend to vote for who we're going to vote for, and we listen to people that agree with us? I don't know. Is there much evidence to show that, yes, there's a lot of bot accounts? Have they really tipped the scale? Or is this just people saying, look, the current leadership has failed. We have one of these bland left-right coalitions in Romania that nobody likes because it never does anything. Like, they never please anyone. Can we see how much of a difference that has made? I mean, that's a very hard thing, I guess, to measure.
It's difficult to measure, but in the case of Romania, the authorities from you know, outside organizations and from inside the country believe that this was very much the deciding factor in that first round of votes. But it's still difficult to quantify it. But
and it's, I think, a convenient scapegoat. General, like, the authorities are the party of the mainstream left and right that are in coalition. Right. And of course they're going to say, hey, it wasn't anything we did, it was the Russians. And again, there's no denying that this was going on, but I think they should probably look in the mirror as well as point the finger.
True, but I would say that it's telling that TikTok, which is a Chinese Communist Party run company, was forced to admit that, yes, it had allowed at least 66,000 accounts inside of Romania to behave in ways that were overtly political without being labeled as overtly political. And that's a violation of TikTok's norms or their rules and guidelines. So they kicked these 66,000 accounts off. And I think that that right there is an admission that this was a, you know, quite a successful strategy, or else the Chinese wouldn't have felt compelled to follow through on that. But the trumpet has actually been warning about Russia's commandeering of internet platforms and the power that they have through this for many years. If you go back to 2018, managing editor Joel Hilliker, he wrote an article called "Wake Up, Russia is Turning Americans Against Americans." And he talks in that article about the 2016 election in the U.S., especially when Russian trolls were taking over several social media platforms, just working in overdrive to foment hatred among Americans and to deepen the divides. And Mr. Hilliker talks about these Russian trolls actually finding articles on InfoWars and other right-wing fringe sites, stories that were not true. And the Russians expended huge amounts of energy to amplify those stories and promulgate them, all for the purpose of making Americans mistrust their government and mistrust each other and hate their government. Mr. Hilliker also talks about how the Russians were able to actually make a big protest happen in Texas by organizing two clashing protests at the same time. And then he writes, shouldn't we feel some shame? Shouldn't this stir some remorse for having let foreign antagonists fiddle with our emotions to turn us against our own countrymen? Shouldn't this be a wake-up call to reunite and redirect our indignation against those who are plainly exposed as trying to sabotage us, end quote. And then from there, Mr. Hilliker gets into the Bible, and he talks about the true author of deception and the true author of these kinds of divide and conquer tactics. So this article was from 2018, as I said, but from this story in Romania, we see that the Russians have continued to use these same tactics, and they're actually using it more and more, I think, to turn countrymen against each other with propaganda. So I think that this article still has a great deal of relevance. And once again, it's called Wake Up, Russia is Turning Americans Against Americans.
And I think the spiritual dimension that you bring up and or that Mr. Hilliker brings up in that article is a really critical one, where, again, this is what's going to separate us from even a lot of so-called Christian news outlets, that the Bible makes clear there is a devil, that he does influence the world, that he is the God of this world. And John chapter 8, Jesus Christ himself says, well, he's a murderer, but he's a liar. That he's been a liar from the beginning, that he loves deceit. He relishes, like, it's a core part of his personality. And that, the deceit all around us is a major sign of his influence in the world. And I think that's another big part of this story, because, yeah, Vladimir Putin is an evil guy, and, you know, he is influenced by Satan the devil, but there's a whole lot of other leaders. I mean, Satan's the god of this world. He's influencing and broadcasting to everyone. You see this with the radical left. You see this with the mainstream media, where there's this whole climate of deceit, and a lot of people don't know who to believe. And I think, you know, you look at what's happening in Georgia, and the way that people are saying, well, Russia stole the election, and that they are bringing about, you know, they're bringing Georgia into the Russian orbit, the country of Georgia there, and that they're taking over Georgia by stealing the election. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that is true. And then you look at, though, people are saying, yeah, but we heard that about January 6th. We were told that, like, we've been told that Russia stole the US election. And so people kind of discount it because they've been told so many lies that were provably lies about Russia being behind Donald Trump, Russia taking over the United States, and Russia interfering politically in the United States. Like, a lot of that was exaggerated. And so then when Russia genuinely does some of these things in Eastern Europe or in the Caucasus, that kind of gets discounted. And people don't, like, nobody in the United States has not reacted at all strongly to what's been going on in Georgia, which is very different if you compare that to, say, 2008 and some of the color revolution. Like, America used to be on top of this. And I think it's because of the climate of deceit that has been created by the mainstream media that America isn't really interested in getting involved.
I think one of the few things that Americans, both on the left and right, agree about these days is that we should sort of pull away from being the global policeman. We've started to see that, you know, on both sides of the aisle. Just more isolationist sentiments that are setting in, and less, you know, less eagerness to try to stabilize what I think Ronald Reagan would have tried to sort of get involved with in places like Georgia. But I did want to quickly mention before we hand it off to Andrew there that, the situation in Georgia, it is becoming very violent right now. Right now, these Russian-aligned agents are just cracking down violently on protesters there. So Georgia, of course, is a little nation there in the Caucasus that was under Moscow's control for almost two centuries, first as part of the Russian Empire, then as part of the Soviet Union. But of course, that all ended in 1991 after the Soviet Union collapsed and Georgia achieved independence. But Russia has been trying ever since then to restore its control over Georgia. We saw that very dramatically with the 2008 war, when Russia conquered a fifth of Georgia's land and made that kind of de facto Russian territory. And now Putin is trying to go even further with that. He recently, I think that the evidence for his having rigged that election there is undeniable. And it was all just to pull Georgia deeper into his orbit. And of course, the people of Georgia are up in arms about this. They're out in the streets fighting for freedom, fighting to avoid becoming the next Belarus or the next Ukraine. These people want to align with Europe instead of Russia. Europe has more rule of law, and so it's more prosperous and it's more free. So it's no surprise that the Georgians want to lean toward Europe instead of Russia. But Putin's agents, they're out there in the streets firing tear gas, cracking heads, doing everything they can to put the protesters down. They're raiding the offices of pro-Europe politicians, arresting many people. So there is fierce fighting on both sides, but it's hard to see how the Georgians could overcome these pro-Russia forces. So we will be keeping a close eye on that conflict.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. as usual, there's been lots going on in the United States as well. I mean, we've been talking about lying and deceit just now. One thing we heard quite a lot all over, through the last 12 months is that Joe Biden would not pardon his son, Hunter. He himself said, I'm not going to do it. Press secretary said repeatedly that Joe Biden would not do that. So, Andrew, can you tell us what happened on this front this week?
Joe Biden pardoned his son, Hunter. Actually, not only did he pardon his son, Hunter, he gave him what's really like a historically broad pardon. It's almost hard to believe that he pardoned his son, Hunter, for any federal crimes he may have committed between January 1st, 2014 and December 1st, 2024. So basically any crimes Hunter committed for a decade, he has been pardoned for. So sweepingly broad pardon. I think a lot of political analysts are saying this is probably the second time in American history a pardon this broad has been issued. After President Nixon resigned, his successor gave him a pardon for anything he may have done while in office, which is very unusual.
Is that something that could be challenged by the courts, do you think, or would that stand?
They might try. I think it will stand because this isn't a law that America was passed or a tradition that's been passed. The actual U.S. Constitution says that the president can issue pardons for federal crimes committed in the past unless they involve an impeachment. They don't actually have to be convicted of it. So now Hunter, he's been accused of committing many state level crimes as well. So it's possible he could still be prosecuted for those. But any federal crimes and any federal crimes he commits after December 1st, if he doesn't stop, could be prosecuted. But I think the general legal rationale is that the Constitution gives the president very broad powers of pardon. So any federal crimes committed in that time period, he cannot be prosecuted for. Now, I think the best suggestion I've heard for those who actually do want some answers about these crimes is because the evidence relating to Hunter also implicates some money peddling schemes that his father, Joe Biden, was in on, and his uncle, and many other members. I think there's 9 members of the Biden crime family that have actually gotten money from foreign governments and some of these influencing campaigns. So maybe you could still prosecute those other members. But this pardon is so broad that it's pretty much an admission that the Biden crime family is guilty. We've talked a lot this program about information wars where some people say Trump's guilty of felonies. Some people say Biden's guilty of felonies. You've got finger pointing going on all over the place. Unless you're really deep into the topic, it's hard to tell what's true. This pardon actually helps the American people in some ways know what's true, because as many good legal analysts have pointed out, if Hunter truly was guilty of nothing more than 2 counts of tax evasion and an illegal gun possession charge, then Biden would have pardoned him for 2 counts of tax evasion and an illegal gun possession charge. This sweeping pardon, which suspiciously starts at the beginning of 2014, which is a couple months before Biden took a position on the Burisma board in Ukraine, and a couple months before they started setting up these overseas counts with Biden, is pretty much an admission that Joe Biden knows that something dodgy started happening at the beginning of 2014. He's not concerned about what Hunter did in 2013. He's concerned about what Hunter did in 2014 and for the past 10 years, and has basically made this pardon to insulate the other members of his family, because That's the main reason he changed his mind, is because for a long time he's saying, I will not pardon Hunter. I will not pardon Hunter. I will not pardon Hunter. Now, all that time, he was thinking that Kamala Harris or himself, one of the two, was going to win the presidential election. So there was no problem saying, like, okay, well, we'll throw Hunter under the bus. We'll charge him with 2 counts of tax evasion. We'll charge him with an illegal gun possession charge. He'll get a slap on the wrist. But the Justice Department and an incoming Democratic administration won't investigate him for any of the big money peddling charges. Then when Trump won the election, he's like, okay, well, the slap on the wrist is just going to open the door to a much more far-reaching investigation into all 9 members of the Biden crime family that are in on the take. And so he hasn't pardoned the other 8 members, so it's possible you could still investigate them. But by pardoning Hunter, you've kind of closed the door that incoming FBI director Kash Patel or whoever was going to use to start looking into these pretty serious allegations. The investigative journalist Lee Smith, who is actually coming here to our campus here at Harvard W. Armstrong College in a week or so, has a pet theory, which hasn't been proven yet, but I really like, where he noted that when Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden were getting ready to face off in the Democratic primary back in 2015, Hillary Clinton started putting together a dossier of incriminating information on the Biden crime family. Then Biden dropped out and Hillary Clinton didn't want to create division in the party, so nothing became of that dossier. But suspiciously, a couple months after that, she did put together a dossier talking about Donald Trump's connection with Russian oligarchs and Donald Trump's connection with Russian prostitutes and other accusations that have been thoroughly investigated and found nothing. Trump's come up innocent in every case. But the information we're having on the Hunter Biden laptop talks about him receiving bribes from the mayor of Moscow the mayor of Moscow's wife and Eastern European prostitutes he was involved with. So Lee Smith is saying, it almost looks like Hillary Clinton took a bunch of crimes that we have documented evidence in email evidence, bank account evidence, photographic evidence from the Hunter Biden laptop, took all those crimes that Hunter was guilty of, and then lazily accused Donald Trump of the same thing. Like, again, that's just a theory to see that if that's actually what Hillary Clinton did. But it's not a theory to say that, like, Hunter Biden and the Biden crime family are guilty of many of the crimes that they're trying to accuse Donald Trump of.
I think that's the interesting thing from the news this week, because so much of the news is in silos. You know, the left listen to their sources, the right listen to their sources, and the, you know, Hunter Biden is corrupt was very much a right-wing story, and you saw nothing about it in the mainstream media. And a lot of the left are just would have just been like, nope, nope, this is Donald Trump propaganda, this is not true, yada, yada, yada. And then Joe Biden does this, and I've seen quite a few commentators on the left that have been this week saying, like, hang on, wait a minute, maybe there is something here then. Like, this pardon is really unusual. Why 2014? Why not exactly the points that you've made? It's such a compelling point that this is no longer a left-right issue, and you're having now people on the left say, oh, maybe this stuff that the right have been saying about Hunter Biden is actually true all along.
Normalizing a sweeping presidential pardon, which, like I said, up till now has only been used in the Nixon case, could make it more routine in America, where, like, every time a president leaves office, he just does a sweeping pardon, which allows almost anyone in his administration to operate under the understanding that they're not accountable for what they're doing. I've even seen, we'll see if Biden goes for it, but he's being pressured by some in the Democratic Party. They said, well, why don't you do one of these pardons for Anthony Fauci? It's getting pretty obvious that, like, he broke several laws and is to help the Wuhan Institute of Virology do bioweapons research. And the many people in the Trump administration want them investigated. So why not just start making a list of people who are going to get pardons down the door, so that you don't be able to bring any of these people to justice.
Well, I've seen
And
people
like I said, these
say, why don't
pardons.
you issue a pardon for the entire administrative state? Like, blanket pardon for the thousands upon thousands of people that work for the US government, which, if you're actively considering that, like, what have you been doing for the last 4 years that that is necessary?
Yeah, that is, like I said, that's circling right back. That is the interesting case, is that, like I said, these pardons, they are kind of a get out of jail free card, literally. But by giving someone one, you pretty much have to admit to the nation and the world that they need a pardon. And this is interesting because remember, Trump's first impeachment was he called a leader in Ukraine and said, "I want you to investigate what the Bidens were doing in Ukraine." And the Bidens were so concerned about that that they literally impeached the President of the United States to make sure that that never got investigated. Now that Trump's coming back and he's like, "Oh, I'm still going to investigate it. I don't care about the impeachment." They're like, "All right, well, blanket pardon." It's like, we do not want anyone to know what we were doing in Ukraine. And they're making it very hard to investigate this. So we talked a lot about earlier about like the Russian bot propaganda, where with the like with the Twitter files, that actually ended up being a huge blessing to the radical left because like yes, there were some Russians using bots and other things on Twitter to sow division in the United States, which by the FBI then used to censor those bots. And then when Elon Musk released the Twitter files, he found out that actually less than 10% of the people censored were actual Russian bots. The other 90% were just conservatives who didn't do anything, who got falsely accused of being a Russian bot. We've got the paper trail in the Twitter files that you look into. It's like, okay, it's like these were the counts that we had proof were Russian bots, and these are the tenfold more accounts that we just censored anyway, because we didn't like what they were saying, and the Russian disinformation gave us the excuse we needed. Which now, ironically, with this pardon, shows that like the whole idea that Trump stole the election from Russia was kind of just like a preemptive measure the Democrats took to highlight the fact that Biden was getting money from Russian oligarchs. They sold out, Hillary Clinton sold out America's like last functioning uranium mine in Wyoming to Russian oligarchs. And so like I said, yeah, just deep levels of corruption within the United States government that the Biden family is now tacitly admitting to with this pardon, to make sure that they're never actually brought to justice. And which actually brings me to the prophetic article I actually brought, taking from a bigger standpoint, an article from an editor-in-chief, Injustice and Lawlessness, a Prophet's Warning, which goes through scriptures in Micah 3, verse 1, that talks about, "Hear you, O heads of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know judgment?" And then the rest of the prophecy goes through just how corrupt the justice system in end time Israel is, to the point where now that even Democrats who've spent the last 8 years defending Biden and defending the Bidens are now saying, well, wait a minute. Why can't Hunter just get a sweetheart deal where he's charged with an illegal gun possession and two tax evasion counts? Why does he need this 11-year blanket pardon insulating him from all these corrupt deals he's done in Ukraine and in Kazakhstan and in China and in Russia and in other nations? Yeah, I guess I'll just finish up with one of the articles we can actually put in the show notes is from our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, titled Presidential Crime Syndicate Exposed, which actually takes you through, because there's a lot of detail, a timeline starting back in 2014 and coming up through modern day of all these activities that the Biden crime syndicate has been involved in. And that's now going to be very hard to bring them to justice because of this pardon, which is really just a travesty on the international scene, because it's like, if you're a foreign company and you want to do business in the United States, it's like, you have to take this into account that, like, is America actually a nation where, like, the government you're doing business with can just do these corrupt business deals and then get a presidential pardon at the end of the term? Because that, it definitely doesn't make your investment safe. You want to do business with a country where the rule of law governs these things. And it's definitely Biden's advertising to the whole world that his family is above the law. And they can do what business deals they want without regard for, like, being investigated or being held to account that every other business person in America has to be subject to.
Well, thank you very much for that, that, Andrew. And I'm just going to do a plug for one of your other articles, actually, as well, that I think relates to several of the stories that we've talked about this week, from the January 2024 Trumpet print edition, The Post-Truth World, The Gatekeepers of Truth Have Proven Unworthy, Lies Are Being Legitimized, What Can You Believe? That I think does get to this thing that we've been talking about. I do feel like the Trumpet, we're in a really unique position, because you'll get a whole lot of people that will say, the West, the mainstream media, they're lying about everything, and Vladimir Putin's the good guy. And then you get the mainstream media that is like, Vladimir Putin is a bad guy, but then having a whole bunch of lies on their road. Like, it is hard. Who do you trust? Because there are lies and there is falsehoods and deceit just about everywhere. And that article, The Post-Truth World, is a fantastically practical guide for navigating this. It doesn't necessarily tie in, I guess, directly to what you've just been talking about, but throughout all of this, I mean, I'm glad you added that context there of Russian bots being used as an excuse to crack down on legitimate people, because I think, yeah, both of these things are true. There are Russian bots, and the deep state has used the existence of Russian bots as an excuse to kick real Americans and off platforms. And that happened even recently, where I think YouTube demonetized a bunch of accounts because they'd been receiving allegedly money from Russia. And I don't think they even knew. They accepted donations. Someone from Russia had donated, and then that was used to get rid of them. So how do you find truth in the post-truth world? And that article is a great place to look at that. And that's really, you know, that's what we set as our mission in the Trumpet, to give you the truth in the post-truth world. I mean, there's a lot of untruth about news. There's a lot of untruth about out there about the Bible. And we want to give you the tools to prove for yourself what is truth, and to build your own relationship with God so that you can get to the truth. And so our magazine, our website, all of that is designed to help you do that. Now, we spent all of Wednesday's show talking about the dramatic news from the Middle East in Syria with the restart of the civil war there. We try to give you just as basic a possible guide to the Syria conflict. So if you want to get caught up with what is going on there, I'd really encourage you to go back and look at Wednesday's show. But that was, of course, several days ago. So to catch us up with what has happened since Wednesday, we'll get a quick update from Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, so if you remember at the very end of last show, I mentioned that the rebels appear to be advancing down this main highway.
The road to Damascus.
Yes, the road
rebels
to Damascus.
Rebels are on the road to Damascus.
They are on the road to Damascus, but for, I guess before Paul was converted, about maybe the same motives to go hunting people down. Looks like they've been having quite a bit of success in that offensive. Since we recorded that program, the rebels Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, have captured Hama City, which...
Hama. Yeah. Okay, yeah, no, just checking. I kind of heard Hamas at first and wanted to make sure.
No, not Hamas. And since they've consolidated their conquest, including at the military airport there. They're now marching their way down that highway again to Homs, which is Syria's third biggest city, roughly about 800,000 people. Some of the communities surrounding the main conquest, like, for example, two Christian-majority towns near Hama, they actually negotiated a surrender to HTS without putting up a fight. And for their part, with the territory they've already conquered, there are reports that HTS is starting to change up the administration, at least in Aleppo, and some of these earlier conquests, with like organizing a new police force, trying to reintegrate Syrian soldiers into the civilian life, whatever that means. So looks like they're in a good position to start consolidating their gains. And to be fair, they still don't have, like, Assad still controls the majority of Syrian territory, even when you factor in the Kurds and some of these other groups. But they are making fast gains. The Syrian military is taking a lot longer to reorganize and regroup than a lot of people were expecting. And this is sending a lot of their allies scrambling to try and help them out. What exactly, if this is just incompetence on Assad's part, or if there is some grander strategy, like temporary setbacks to push them back once and for all, that could very well be in play. But Assad is showing himself, or at least his military, to be a lot weaker than almost everybody, friend or foe, was anticipating.
Right, because this is a massive setback for Assad. Like these rebels are now coming to the Alawite heartlands, and we talked about that last time, the Alawites being this minority from which Assad draws a lot of his power. And if they continue advancing like this, they're going to cut Damascus off from the Alawite heartlands. Like, this is...
They're going to cut the Mediterranean coastline from the rest of his controlled territory, including all those Russian assets that we were talking about last time.
So he's got to stop the rebels and turn them around pretty soon, or he's toast.
Exactly. A lot of people are making comparisons that what we're seeing right now, it's not a clean-cut comparison, but what we're seeing right now in Syria is remarkably similar to what the Taliban was doing in 2021 in Afghanistan, with just this lightning offensive and a government that may have a lot of shiny tools from foreign backers, but when push came to shove, it was a house of cards and the whole structure comes falling down. I think Russia and Iran are taking this a little bit more seriously than the United States did in 2021. There are rumors, per Ukrainian intelligence sources, that Russia is moving some of its soldiers from its various interests in Africa over to Syria. Of course, it may seem like it's part of the same part of the world, but it's still pretty far away, so who knows how fast it would take to get those soldiers into Syria. And, I mean, Putin can't afford to lose Syria that well either. He's obviously bogged down in Ukraine, but it would be a pretty humiliating loss for him to just give up Syria without a fight like this. So he's probably not going to just sign a piece of paper and cut his losses so fast. But either way, it is still looking pretty bad, both for Assad and his foreign backers.
So dramatic events in Syria. And of course, we're watching for Syria to shift out from the Iranian orbit and for them to shift into the European orbit. And I try to give a very simple breakdown of exactly why we're expecting that based on Bible prophecy on Wednesday's show. So you can go back and look at that. I think over the next few days, we'll probably just post that prophetic breakdown that's 20 minutes or so just by itself. So if you don't want to watch the entire 1 hour and 20 minutes, it took us a lot longer than I thought it would to try and just keep everything as simple as possible going through Syria. But if you want to just get the prophetic angle there, we'll have that shortly as a standalone video. So thank you so much to all of our panelists today. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch. trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back on Wednesday. And until then, keep watching your world.